This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As Congress, the White House, the Fed, and the Treasury Department struggle over the size, shape, and nature of the Wall Street bailout, much of the blame game has focused on an unhappy aspect of human nature. Greed. The subprime mortgage debacle that poisoned Main Street and then Wall Street? Greed. Marauding lenders peddled interest-only mortgages to people who didn't even have to prove they had a job, and corporations never questioned financial instruments they didn't quite understand because they brought in huge profits. But we all blew up this bubble. And now, as we face staggering consequences, it's time to ask the nagging little question, could they have done it without us? Were we too keen to flip our houses, sign up for more credit, roll over our balances? Later in the hour, NATO Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer joins us to take your calls about Afghanistan and Georgia and Russia. But first, greed and the financial panic. Blame it on the lenders or the bankers, but could they have done it without us? Fess up. Tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we start with Michael Bolden, the copy and production chief at the Washington Post magazine, who wrote a story about getting in a little over his head financially when he bought what he called the house of his dreams. The story appeared in the magazine over the weekend. Michael Bolden joins us from the offices at the Washington Post. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Nice to be here, Neil.
And not long after you brought your dream house, you write, it turned into a financial nightmare.
Well, we should have seen what was happening at the very beginning. We were hoping to parlay the purchase of this home into wealth. From the very beginning, we were encountering some financial difficulty. I think that was inspired in part by what was an overwrought and overzealous market. We were counting on using the money that we had from our current house, which we were selling, to buy the new property. We ran into trouble when the person who was buying our home, their loan fell through 2 days before closing. And that sort of set off a cascade of events that led us down a path that we probably shouldn't have gone down. This person couldn't afford to buy our house. And so we were like, well, we really want this new house. We were really pursuing this dream. It was a wonderful old house that sort of typified, I think, what a lot of Americans want.
And you describe one terrible morning when you go to the closing and you're being asked to sign off on terms for two mortgages that you hadn't seen before that morning, were nothing like what had been described to you. And yet you felt, you guys had bought houses before. This was your fourth house that you'd bought. Nevertheless, with all that experience, you felt tremendous pressure to go ahead and sign.
Well, I knew we had been waiting for a month. The people we were buying the house from had graciously sort of agreed to wait on us, but I knew that they were also pursuing a dream. They were retiring and moving from the immediate area, so they weren't going to wait forever. And we had gone to a mortgage broker, told him, a general outline of terms that we wanted. We were counting on being able to get into the house and refinance into a more favorable mortgage. And at that day at the closing table, we were faced with a mortgage that had prepayment penalties, whose interest rate was slightly higher than I think we had had banked on. And so the terms were kind of onerous. And we were faced with the question, do we sign off on these documents and go ahead? Or do we say no and stop the process and risk losing the house? We weren't willing to risk losing the house. And given the availability of easy money at the time, we didn't think it would be a problem refinancing into something more favorable.
Yet, even though you'd put a lot of work into the house and hoped that a couple of years later you could refinance and get out from under this, the storm clouds had gathered by then.
Well, the storm clouds had gathered, and there was another aspect of the situation that conspired against us. One of the things that happened when the market was overheated was that you had everybody was so busy, the loan brokers, the appraisers, that they really didn't have time to, cross all the T's and dot the I's. When we got ready to refinance, we discovered that the appraiser had actually made a mistake and erroneously put down the square footage of the house as being more than it actually was. so that when someone actually had time to do a considered appraisal, the house was actually valued at less than we thought it would have been at that point.
And less, in fact, than you'd paid for it.
That's exactly right. By the time we'd paid for the house, we put money into renovations, we actually found ourselves on the losing end.
So this house that you'd hoped to, fix up in a couple of years, make a very fancy bedroom, and you did some of the repairs, but the roof hasn't been fixed and all that stuff. Nevertheless, you're now still living in it. You'd hope to have sold it by now and be living in Florida.
Well, we were our previous home. We actually it doubled in value in 4 years in the market, and so we thought that we could buy this house it would double in value after we'd put some money into it, and that we'd be able to sell it for well over $1 million. We were going to take that profit and probably move to Florida. Americans traditionally have built wealth through their homes, and we were no different. That's exactly what we were trying to do. And, of course, none of that came to pass as the market collapsed.
And to some degree, you've got to blame your was it greed?
Oh, we were definitely greedy. We were motivated by a couple of different things. We already had a lovely home that we could still be living in this day. But this house, the one that we were buying, was, somewhat special. It was an older house sitting on 2 acres of land, and that was a dream that we'd always wanted to pursue. But at the same time, we had seen what could happen if you made the right real estate investment and how your money could double. So we wanted to capitalize on even more of that. And our friends all around us were sort of caught up in the same thing, where we had people in the neighborhood we were living in at the time were all looking to buy that next house and find that next real estate deal that would, get them the most bang for the buck. So and of course, now we all find ourselves in a very different place from where we thought we'd be.
And a bunch of foreclosure signs up there, too. But it was a culture.
That's exactly right. If we went to a dinner party or you're just talking with someone across the fence on a Saturday morning, what you'd be talking about was, the unbelievable fortune you'd had to see your property, double in value. That's an extraordinary thing to have happened in only 4 years' worth of time.
Go ahead.
We had our house go from the one that we were living in at the time. We paid $240 for it. When we sold that house, we sold it for almost $500,000, and that's just in 4 years.
Well, Michael Bolden, we thank you for telling us your story and sharing it with us. And good luck. You still got a nice house, don't you?
It is a very lovely home. We are going to continue to stay there. We're going to fix it up gradually, and we hope this market recovers.
Thanks very much. Michael Bolden, copy and production chief of The Washington Post. His story about getting in over his head financially appeared in The Washington Post magazine this past Sunday. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We're talking about our part and the part that greed played in this particular crisis that we're facing as a country. Let's see if we can get James on the line. James calling us from Lodi in California.
How are you doing today?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah, my basic comment is that there was greed on all parts, and me personally as a homeowner chose to take the easy way out in getting more of the material items by refinancing my home and getting extra stuff that I really shouldn't have gotten or could afford.
The material things, that almost sounds spiritual.
a little bit, but I mean, it was more of wanting what everybody else had, new car, bigger TV, making your house nicer, getting the refinancing. In my case, I had refinanced with a HELOC, and when I got to the paper signing, they had, instead of doing the original amount that we had agreed upon, they had given me the full estimated value of my home. And so instead of me stopping where I should have stopped, I kept borrowing against it to get this thing or that thing or the other thing, taking, the kids on a vacation, whatever have you. Instead of being responsible about my money and managing it wisely, I went ahead and made some pretty bad errors.
James, thanks for the call. We suspect you're not alone, but we appreciate you sharing your story.
Thank you.
Let's bring another voice into the discussion. Jim Wallace is the founder and president of Sojourners, a Christian evangelical ministry based in Washington, D.C. He wrote a piece for On Faith, dealing with morality and the economy. He joins us now from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
And there's been a lot of finger-pointing at Wall Street and plenty of blame to go around, but the greed was not all on one side, was it?
You know, this word greed is really now entered the conversation in a way that I was really startled by. You know, Robert Samuelson, a venerable economist, greed and fear, which routinely governed financial markets, have seeded this global crisis. Short-term rewards blinded them to the long-term dangers. I think, Neil, this is both structural and spiritual. And the answers are going to be a combination of social regulation, but also self-regulation.
Greed, famously one of the seven deadly sins, but
exactly.
Also an aspect of human nature. It's more is a familiar emotion.
Gandhi had seven deadly sins that Gandhi talked about. He said one was wealth without work, commerce without morality, politics without principle. Those were three of them. I live in Washington, D.C., too. And your sad story about the guy at the Post.
Mm-hmm.
When your house doubles in 4 years, its value. Does anybody think you've earned that? It's a luck of place. My brother lives in Detroit, my hometown. He runs a neighborhood service organization that takes care of mentally ill and homeless people. His house, he now has a $130,000 mortgage. His house is now worth $60,000. But in Washington, D.C., my neighborhood was a war zone for years. Now it's a very hot real estate market. And, you know, what they would do is they would say, you know, you could take an equity loan and you could buy a second house and then a third and a fourth, borrow money to spend money. And that's what Wall Street did, and that's what we did at the bottom, and that's why we're in trouble.
Now stay with us, if you will, Jim Wallace. We're going to continue talking about greed and the financial meltdown. What was your part, if any, in blowing up the bubble? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, warned Congress today that it risks a national recession if it doesn't move quickly on the administration's $700 billion bailout plan. Lawmakers from both parties say they need time to consider the proposal. Stay with NPR News all week for the latest on where the plan stands. You can find links to some of the best reporting on the topic at our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Today, our focus not so much on Wall Street and corporate banks, but on, well, the streets where all of us live. Blame it on the lenders or the bankers, but could they have done it without us? Fess up. Were you greedy? Tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Jim Wallace is with us, founder and president of Sojourners, a Christian evangelical ministry here in Washington, D.C. He wrote a piece for On Faith dealing with morality and the economy. And we can see morality playing a part in this, certainly in terms of the institutions which are responsible for this and those who should have been overseeing them. But we are also have personal moral responsibilities.
Well, this thing, Neil, has been a morality play, watching this sort of unfold. And I said in my blog this morning that you know, the CEOs should be paraded down Wall Street in sackcloth and ashes. I think that's true. But we also should, all of us, do some self-examination here. We forgot something very important. It's called the common good, the common good. Wall Street just threw that to the wind. And so, as your callers say, when the economy is rooted in an unbridled kind of materialism, when the culture extols greed, when we have a false sense of values that put short-term profits over societal health, and then this distorted calculus that we all fall into that measures human worth, if you will, by personal income instead of character, integrity, generosity, something goes very badly wrong. So this is a consequence of deregulation, an economic philosophy that now governs America. The markets are good and government's bad. That's going to go out the window now. But it's more than that. It's also a consequence consequence of greed, where we forget that the private interests are finally going to be shaped by what happens in the common good. We're going to be responsible for each other one way or the other. And the common good is a deeply religious concept in all of our traditions. It's in our American political tradition. And we just forgot to, all of us, not just social regulation, but, as I say, self-regulation, too. What is best for the common good? We've lost that, and now the common good is going to really suffer.
Here's an email we have from Alan in St. Louis, Missouri. Of course people are greedy. Which of us will settle for a modest pile of cash if a larger one is within reach? If people weren't greedy, they wouldn't need regulation, but they are, and we do. If everybody who is greedy were to blame, the blame could be shifted to the public, but the public is not to blame for being human. Those who foolishly opposed regulation when the need for it is so obvious are the guilty ones. Well, let's bring... you wanted to say something about that?
Well, human nature is indeed involved here. But, you know, there are our better angels and our lesser angels, and it is also human to care for each other and to care for the common good, to look out for each other. That's part of being human, too. We've lost our balance. We've lost our balance. Today, we're going to be calling for... the old idea of a religious tithe, 10% of the $700 billion, we think should go to keeping low-income people in their homes and putting them back in their homes. Community organizations that can do that job, we should begin to 70%, $70 billion, 10% tithe. I want to tell Paulson, tithe 10% of that $700 billion for those who are really at the bottom. Those at the top who made bad decisions are all still getting rich. Those at the bottom who didn't make the bad decisions are the ones who are suffering the most. So, again, it's a good teachable moment here, Neil. I think, this is a crisis, and we all know the Chinese symbol for crisis is danger and opportunity. Both of those symbols together make crisis. There's terrible danger here, but if this is an opportunity to look at ourselves, Wall Street, yes, Washington, yes, but at ourselves, how are we really taking account of each other and the common good? There could be some redemption here through all this.
Let's talk with Elliot. Elliot's on the line with us from New Boston in New Hampshire.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, Elliot. Go ahead, please.
Well, I remember the savings and loan crisis of the late 90s, and people were supposed to learn a lesson there, and you just watch the whole thing happen over and over again with loan officers that were very familiar with the use of whiteout, believe it or not, committing all kinds of acts of fraud. I was reporting property values honestly, doing my small part, but there was constant pressure to come in with higher numbers, relentless. And the one company that really comes to mind would be AmeriQuest.
A company that has since gone on to some more harder times.
Harder times is putting it nicely, yeah.
Well, we try to be polite.
They were on a monthly pay period, and you get to the end of the pay period, and the phone calls were absolutely relentless from the loan officers because their managers were pushing them so hard. And it was, trickled down from California. They were all feeding at the trough, and they were really packing it away.
Elliot, thanks very much for the call. For another take on greed, we're joined now by Russell Roberts. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. His new book is called The Price of Everything, A Parable of Possibility and Prosperity. He joins us from the studios of member station WETA in Arlington, Virginia. And nice to talk with you again.
Hello, Neil.
And you may not agree with the famous words uttered by the character Gordon Gekko in the movie Wall Street, greed is good, but in a capitalistic system, isn't there some virtue to greed?
Well, greed, if we define it in the spiritual way, is not good. It's the graspingness of it isn't good. But self-interest, the pursuit of all kinds of dreams to get ahead, is part of not just what makes us human, but what makes us great and what makes our standard of living as high as it is, what supports the innovation and creativity that makes our economy so successful. The challenge is to keep that self-interest from harming others in a well-functioning system, which ours is most of the time. The way you get ahead, the way you make a lot of money, is by providing goods and services to your fellows that they value. If you don't do that, you'd have trouble making a living. If you don't provide a skill that other people value, you have trouble making a living. And that works pretty well. It breaks down when the natural feedback loops that restrain self-interest from turning into greed or destructive and harming others, when those feedback loops are broken. And I have a different perspective from my fellow guest. I think, unfortunately, a lot of our concern for the common good that he extols is the source of our problem, not the solution.
In what way?
Well, there's some other folks who are greedy in this story that we didn't talk about yet, and those are Barney Frank and President Clinton and President Bush and Andrew Cuomo, people who, in a good cause, wanted to increase home ownership, changed a lot of the rules and regulations to increase lending to people who couldn't afford those houses. The whole Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac meltdown is due to pressure from Congress and from the Housing and Urban Development, from HUD, to encourage them in the subprime loan business. They were massive financiers of the subprime problem. And, of course, they did so with our money. That was a good cause, encouraging poor people to own homes who didn't own them before. But we are going to end up paying for them, and that is part of the problem as well. The challenge is to find a way to put back the feedback loops of responsibility that are also part of human nature. The idea of being prudent, the idea of dreaming but not with other people's money, the idea of dreaming, and if your dreams don't work out, you bear the responsibility. That's what's been lost in the last 10 years through a whole bunch of both private and public errors. We have to put those back. But to lump it together as part of human nature, greed goes back to either the Garden of Eden or when man came out of the savannah, depending on your your religious perspective. And we have found different methods of restraining it. Capitalism is a pretty successful way. The financial markets lately have broken down partly through their own errors but partly through government errors, and we want to try to fix it. It's not going to be easy.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation. Pat with us from Cleveland.
Hi.
Hi, Pat.
I disagree with the premise that the average citizen is responsible because, first of all, I agree with your last guest that simply pursuing a lot of profit in an available economy isn't greed, it's simply opportunity. And if anybody's gone into a mortgage loan transaction, a closing, the average person at that table on the one side, in other words, the non-lender, they don't know what loan-to-value ratios are and they don't know what ROI is. And they're relying on the bank to make sure that the things are done in accordance with industry standards and law. And I think a lot of this happened, and if you sit down and the banker says to you, psst, you don't have enough income, but we're going to push it through anyways, that person is greedy and that person's at fault. But that's not 99% of these transactions. 99% of the transactions is the lenders knowing that what they were doing was inconsistent with industry standards and telling the people, don't worry, ladies and gentlemen, you can still buy that house and borrow that money and it'll be okay. They defrauded those customers, and that's what caused this problem.
Perhaps there's certainly an element of that in it, too, but they couldn't have done it without us.
No. I disagree because, again, if I come to the table, and I'm a lawyer, if I come to the table and the person says to me, Mr. Perotti, what should I do here? And they're relying on me to know the law and the regulations better than they do. I'm supposed to follow them. And those people in those, and I know because I do class actions in this field, the people in that field, in those loan offices, they did not follow the law. They misrepresented the value of properties. They dummied up appraisals. That's illegal. And that's what led people to get loans that they wouldn't necessarily know they couldn't afford, but the lenders who were giving them should have known and did know, and they were banking on the housing market continuing to keep its value, and when it didn't, the whole game fell apart. That was the lender's fault, not the borrower's.
All right. Go ahead, Russell.
That's half the story, and some of it was fraud and dishonesty, and again, you can call that greed. The other half is there was pressure on those lenders to soften those standards, change use credit scores instead of more traditional methods, use automated underwriting from Fannie and Freddie, and those lenders made those loans irresponsibly because they knew they could sell them to someone else. Now, some of the people they sold those loans to were Fannie and Freddie, who were backed by you and me, unfortunately, and they went bust. Some of them they sold to private sector folks who thought they could hedge themselves from the risk. They thought they had sophisticated models of risk that could make sure that they weren't at serious risk. They misestimated. They were overconfident. And as the caller says very correctly, in a time of rising housing prices, those kind of mistakes don't come back to haunt you. As soon as prices start to fall, you get the meltdown that we're in the middle of.
Neil?
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I want to be careful here that we're not blaming this crisis on poor people who wanted to buy houses. I mean, there's all over the world, there's a very very powerful movement going on of a responsible lending to low-income people to start businesses, capital houses that is focused on how to bring people into the economy. These lenders were not trying to just help poor people buy houses. They were out to make a buck for themselves. And then, as others have said, it got all packaged and it got, you know, sold and resold and resold. So I think there was clear responsibility at the higher levels here because of the combination of deregulation, government's bad, market is good, and greed. And greed, Samuelson, Rubin, they're all talking about greed. It's like a morality play. But we also need to look at all of us in terms of our own values. And your callers have been saying this. Do we really need that thing that we thought we needed? It's how I got a 5-year-old and a 10-year-old. And the message to them all the time is you're going to be more important and valuable as a person if you have PlayStation 3 instead of PlayStation 2, or if you have 2 houses and 3 houses and 4 houses. So we do need to look at ourselves. At the same time, there are people who are responsible for this crisis. They've made decisions that have compromised the common good, and they're the ones. Many of them are not going to suffer from this, but many others are, and they should be held accountable.
Jim Wallace is the founder and president of Sojourners. Also with us is Russell Roberts, a professor of economics at George Mason University. We're talking about the financial crisis and greed. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Brian's on the line. Brian with us from Cleveland.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, I just heard Jim Wallace on there. And I come from a shared perspective with him. I come from the Anabaptist tradition, you know, which is the Brethren Amish Mennonite. And I was commenting that I've seen a lot of the greed, if you will, developing in our groups, which have been, you know, historically very frugal, very plainly. And I've seen, especially over the last 5-10 years, especially with the housing, people getting involved with trouble. But, you start seeing the Lexuses and the BMWs in our parking lots. And it's a growing factor that even, you know, those that have historically, you know, shunned that kind of living are getting just as much caught up in it as anything else. So I don't know if that's human nature or what, but there's a discussion in our groups of, you know, do we need to go back to that simpler time? And, you know, have we gone too far and how we've let capitalism, you know, overrun some of our more socialist ideas that have been in the past of, you know, living together and common sharing.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. And let me ask both of our guests, Russell Roberts, if to the extent that greed was responsible, what qualities of human nature do we need to look to now to help us resolve this situation?
Well, if we're going to fix this problem by changing human nature, we're going to be in for a very long wait. And I suggest that we get very patient because human nature is eternal. It doesn't change. And I think, again, the solution is to change the incentives. As the economist in the room, I want to emphasize that money isn't everything. It's not the goal of life to get the most toys. That's not what economists or economics believes. It's very important to remember that there are trade-offs between the material and the spiritual, and our time is very precious. We shouldn't spend all our time at work. Those are all incredibly important lessons. The key thing to focus on, though, from an economics insight is the role of incentives. I would argue that one of the serious reasons we're in the mess we're in is that people were allowed to spend other people's money rather than their own. When you spend your own money, you're prudent. When you spend other people's money, you are less careful. And again, that is the same whether you are Fannie Mae, whether you are a politician, or whether you are a lender. And too many times, the incentives were structured so that people could spend other people's money in a good cause sometimes for low-income homeownership or one's own well-being or one's own dreams. But when you spend other people's money, you're not as careful.
I don't want to cut you off, but I wanted to give Jim Wallace a chance to answer the same question because we just have about a minute left.
Well, I think it'd be a wonderful outcome if those at the top of the economy were not allowed to spend other people's money in the way Russell's talking about, and if we all took heed to what he's saying about that money isn't the measure of things. And it's one thing to say that. It's another thing to live in a different kind of way. Enough is enough. What's enough? What does simplicity really mean? And for people, of faith, what does our faith mean in the midst of this financial crisis? I mean, where do these Wall Street folks go to church? What have they ever heard of church from preachers and pulpits about? The Bible talks about this stuff through and through, wealth and poverty, rich and poor. There's 2,000 verses on this subject that we're talking about today in the Bible. And we have been reading our Bibles, how you treat employers, how you treat the poor, how you treat each other. So I think if this causes a renewal, a self-reflection, a looking at ourselves, self-regulation is as important as social regulation. We need both now more than ever before.
Brian, thanks so much for the call. Interesting question. And Russell Roberts, thanks to you today.
Thank you, Neil.
Russell Roberts, professor of economics at George Mason. His new book, The Price of Everything, A Parable of Possibility and Prosperity, with us from member station WETA in Arlington, Virginia. Jim Wallace, founder and president of Sojourners. He was with us today from member station KQED in San Francisco. Coming up, we'll talk with the Secretary General of NATO. Talk of the Nation, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Citgo and its nearly 8,000 locally owned stations, donating heating oil to more than a million Americans. Citgo, there at every turn. From Lenovo, making ThinkPad and IdeaPad personal computers and donating 1% of its income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. And from the Music Performance Fund, striving to enrich lives by sponsoring thousands of public concerts in the United States. Schedules at musicpf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A hacker broke into Sarah Palin's email account using little more than information you can find on Google. I'm Neil Conan, Passwords, Hackers, and Your Email. How safe are we online? Plus a new documentary about one of the most respected, best-liked, and most hated political warriors in America, Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.